Coppell's Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.
Welcome to the Worcester Report, a program of stories, Christian devotions, and music. Broadcast on CWCP, Coppell's Western Cape Radio.
South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God. South Africa, turn back to God.
Welcome to the Worcester Reports on CWCP Radio. This is Tony Coppell. Did you know that as you drive along the N1 or any of the other major roads in South Africa, people have been praying for your safety? I certainly didn't know that, but that's what Highway Ministry does. And it's not just in South Africa. This is an international organization. But I am privileged to be a neighbor to the Worcester representative for Highway Ministry. His name is Farrell von der Westhuizen, and this week he was kind enough to come and talk to me for a little while about this extraordinary ministry. I think you're going to enjoy this, and it will open your eyes, and it'll make you feel safer next time you travel to Cape Town.
Farrell von der Westhuizen, welcome to CWCP Radio.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure being here, and I always enjoy talking about things like this, and yes, thank you for inviting me.
Well, I've invited you because you are the main person here in Worcester involved in Highway Ministry. And Highway Ministry is an international movement, but let's just talk about Highway Ministry South Africa. And for those of you who are making notes, that's highwayministry.co.za. And Farrell, please outline how Highway Ministry got started in 1995, I think it was.
That was in 1995, yes. The actual vision bearer of Highway Ministries, Mr. Jan de Brein, who's situated in Heidelberg in Gauteng, he got the word, the Lord called him. He was editor of a very huge newspaper, and the Lord called him from there, and he gave him the scriptures and said, this is your calling. You go out and call people in from the roads onto the accident-prone South Africa, and you start ministering to the highways and the byways of this country. And that's how he came about to take it from there. And I'll tell you what, Jan was really running with what he started, and it's going strong at the moment. So that's about it, in short. Yeah,
I'm almost embarrassed because it wasn't till I was talking to you just yesterday that I knew anything about it at all.
That's right.
Do you fly under the radar, or am I just not in the right circles?
Yeah. No, we tend to sort of keep it low profile. I did at this point in time. I really thought everybody knew what I was doing, but I was mostly doing things all myself because I never had help. I never had people come to say, really, can I join you? Can I join you? I've got no people really excited to go out and do what I do. And I've done most of this work I've done by myself. Here and there, people have come in to help. Yes, but that's it. I don't, at this point in time, stand on the corners and shout and say, listen, I'm Highway Ministries. No. But I've spoken about Highway Ministries in lots of the churches in Worcester, yes.
Actually, why don't you then tell us what your involvement is now in the ministry, the sort of scope of what you do?
All right. What we do is that we organize prayer meetings, and I've done a few of those in the city hall. I've done on the church square, and I have also done outreaches at the garages situated north and south of Worcester on the highway, because we, as far as prayer is concerned, we protect the N1 running through from the south right up to the north. And then the next partition, shall I say, of highway ministry takes over from there again. We guard the roads by way of prayer from here to try and make it a safe place to drive on. And my involvement is that I promote highway ministries as far as I can with the churches. I try and get the church communities involved in this. But as I say, they're not always prepared to come out and help us. But most of the ministers, the pastors here in Worcester, they know about me. And they always say, listen, can we help? Can we do this? Can we do that for you? But as I say, it takes a bit of time to really get highway ministries known under all spheres of the community.
Highway Prayer Patrol is sort of a project within highway ministries. Can you tell us about Highway
Absolutely,
Prayer Patrol?
Absolutely, yes. As I said, now we protect the roads by way of prayer, and Highway Prayer Patrol is that exactly that I said now, that we go out and we pray for people. Where we do our outreaches, I put up placards, I put up banners, and we make that a prayer point at certain stages, like, for instance, at the Ultra Cities. We make that a prayer point. And when the trucks roll in for diesel or when they come just for a stop, we normally go to the truck driver or the bus driver or even the taxi driver. We go there and we ask him, listen, are you all right? Has your road been safe so far? Where are you going to? And we ask him, does he know the Lord? Does his passengers know the Lord? Does he mind us giving him pamphlets? And we hand out pamphlets to these people. We hand out Bibles. We hand out all sorts of literature, Christian-wise, to try and get them involved in Christianity. Most of the truck drivers, I would say 9 out of 10 of the truck drivers, are so anxious to receive the Bibles that we do get to give them, because it's a special trucker's Bible that we give them with a piece every day in it, and they are so anxious to get hold of it. And most of them, I would say at least 50% of them, get out of the truck and say, listen, I'm going on my road, would you pray for me? And we actually pray for the driver right there where he is. Some would say, listen, can we go to your tent, or can we go to where you are set up? Can you really pray for us? And we anoint them, and we give them whatever they need. If they need a Bible, we'll give them another Bible and send them on the way. We also do that with taxi drivers, but we do find it's better speaking to the taxi passengers than speaking to the driver. They are always so busy counting their passengers, counting their money, that they don't always get involved. We've given them placards, we've given them literature, and they normally just throw it into the taxi and they, okay, I'll do that later on. But most of the passengers are so eager also to receive the Christian literature that we do give them. Yes, and prayer patrol is exactly what it is. We'll go from place to place and we'll pray for the people. And it doesn't have to be at an outreach. We can go there any time of the day, for instance, on a Sunday afternoon or on a Saturday or a Friday evening, go to the Ultra City and just go walk around and say, listen, can I pray for you guys? I've done that with the truck stops here. I go there, and even the young ladies serving behind the counter at the kiosk, I go there, listen, are you not busy? Can I come in? Can I pray for you quickly? Yes, by all means, come and do that. And I've anointed the owners of these truck stops. I've prayed for them. Well, I don't know how many people we've prayed for already, and that we have already anointed. You do get different type of responses. People, as I said, are very eager to find it and receive it, but you also get those people that say, listen, please, that's not my thing. I don't want you to pray for me. I'm all right. Don't do it. But I know that once you think you're right, you're definitely not all right. But we have also had people that say, listen, I don't mind you praying for me, but stand there, but just don't touch me. So you get different kind of responses, and we accept it as it is. So, and if people really say, listen, I'm not in the Christianity thing, I said, thank you very much, but can I give you some literature? And we still hand him some literature. What I've also done with a bus driver of a big passenger bus, that he's actually come and said, listen, no, you don't pray for me. I said, can I get into the bus? I'll pray for the passengers. He says, no, don't come in, and I don't want that. So what I did, I took my anointing oil And I went around and I anointed the bus. I went right around the bus and I anointed the bus and I prayed for the bus and said, Lord, please keep them on the road, keep them safe. They know where they're going. So it's quite interesting, yes.
It sounds as if when I drive to Cape Town that somebody has probably prayed for that stretch of road or the drivers going along there. Is this so?
Absolutely, absolutely. Because what we have also done, and we've had some traffic officers come and sort of looked at us, you know, are we really crazy? Because we've run across the road and we've actually anointed the tarmac. And we poured out anointing oil on the tarmac itself. And we stood there in a row praying for the road itself to say, road, you will keep these people safe. So, yes, the roads you drive on are prayed for. All general traffic running on that road are being prayed for all the time, sir.
South Africa's road death statistics are high, and I know that's part of the reason that you do this, and this ministry exists, but it's less than a third of Zimbabwe's. They have 75 per 100,000 people killed in traffic accidents, and that's the number one country in the world. A little close for comfort, I think, here. And Africa is way the worst continent for traffic deaths. I don't know if you've ever heard or have any ideas as to why that may be. Is there something about Africa or something about the way driving is taught in Africa that means we have these dreadful statistics? Any ideas?
There are a couple of things that come to mind. As I said to you earlier, alcohol plays a bit of a role there, but I think the main thing is that schooling is the big thing that lacks far behind. I don't think there are proper schooling as far as road, shall I say, rules are concerned, because, I mean, you get people that really, they should pass another vehicle when the road is clear, when they can see far, and when they can see there are no other vehicles coming towards them. And then, if it's safe then go past. But what is happening now at the moment is that people really do pass on blind rises. They pass on blind corners. And I don't know whether they just think they can't see a vehicle coming and that's all right, now I can go. But I think there needs to be a huge amount more of schooling as far as road rules are concerned. How to read a road. Impatience is a big thing as well, specifically under a certain group of drivers, because he makes money. He drives like crazy to get to the other side, to offload his passengers, get them back here again, or get the taxi back here again to pick up his next load. So the more trips he can do, the more money he makes. And there are a lot of people that really don't get enough sleep. There should be a rule against people that don't sleep and really want to overdo it. But then also you get cars, taxis, buses, trucks that are totally not roadworthy. And that is also a big contribution towards road accidents. If you want to see some of the tires that people drive on, I mean, I won't even give that to a kid of mine to roll it around the yard like that, but leave alone still having it on a vehicle. So, yes, there are plenty of factors that really contribute towards road deaths. But I think schooling is a big, shall I say, a lack of what is happening here. There should be more schooling, absolutely.
We've been talking so far about traffic accidents insofar, you know, a car hits a truck or whatever. But a lot of people die on the roads who are cyclists and pedestrians. And is that part of the vision here for highway ministries as well, or is that a separate thing?
It sort of comes in as part of it because, as I said to you, when we pray for the road, in our prayers, there are always the pedestrian using the road. Some pedestrians just cross the road. They are totally unaware, oblivious of vehicles driving on that same piece of road. Some people, I've spoken to people already that said to me, listen, but I can cross the road because the cars can see me. I will cross. So, you know, if you go to that extreme to think other people will see you, and I can just cross the road. Then motorcycles, high speeds, a lot of accidents on motorcycles, and then cyclists. If you look in town, if you look on the highways, people with bicycles, they really go, they drive, or they cycle at night with dark clothing on, no lights, no reflectors.
On the wrong side of the road.
And on the wrong side of the road, exactly. On the wrong side of the road. I mean, you've had the experience of that as well. So, yes, that happens. It's something to really look at and something to think of and something that gets you a bit agitated as well. So,
my next question you've already answered to some degree, because I wanted to sort of take us on one of your night trips when you go out and give us a feel for what it would be like, how long you're out there for. Bearing in mind you've already given us some answered some of that question.
Okay.
Just let's imagine that tonight you're going out. What would happen?
I would go out and set up. I put up a gazebo, provided the wind doesn't take me with him. And I'll put up a gazebo or a tent or even a truck, and we'll go out, put out pamphlets, and then we'll start roaming through the cars that are there at the truck stops, at the ultra cities, at the garages, wherever, and we'll start praying for the people at their vehicles, or we'll invite them to us. And we have banners all over to say, we are praying for you, please come and pray with us. So we actually invite them. The banners are part of the invitation out to them. And if I can just quickly tell you what I did on Easter weekend this year when I was out at the Alta City, I went there on the Thursday afternoon, just after 12 in the afternoon I went there. And I started setting up, and I was there right through the night praying, and I had some ladies from town driving that couple of k's out to the Alta City to come and sit and pray there for an hour or two. And I've had some of the pastors come out and help me there to pray. And I stood there the whole night, and I packed up the next day 2 o'clock. So, yes, we will go through the night and get things going. And because there are a lot of people, and you see the rush early in the evening, and then you'll find a slack. And then here from about 12 o'clock to about 2 o'clock in the morning, and you'll find that rush again. And then there's a bit of a slack, and then early morning from about 4 o'clock onwards, you'll find the rush again. So we try and get all of those into our prayer session that we're going out for. Yes.
Don't you ever sleep, Farrell? Because you get up pretty early in your day job.
Yes, I do that. I'm a very early go-to-bedder, if I can call it that. Yes, I go to bed early in the evenings. But from my years on the road, I can maybe tell you about that just now. That was my best time, getting up in the mornings, 2 o'clock. And I'm still sort of into that groove of getting up in the mornings. Now I get up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm off to work at 4 o'clock. And that helps me go through a prayer evening like that, yes. So it's quite good.
I think you must now tell us what kind of work you're doing now.
All right. I'm with a transport company, and we also do storage, but we transport furniture. And our trucks run countrywide. We do furniture removals from one place to the other. And it's quite demanding work getting the logistics put together to see that your truck is on its way to Joburg with a full load, and to make sure that it's loading there again to come back on a full load. Because in today's economy, I don't think you can really afford to have a truck running empty one way or the other. Yes, yeah, so it's quite demanding to get up and go there, and that's why I do it in the quiet time of the morning. I also have my quiet time when I get to the office. Then once I've done that, I start and I sit and I put the paperwork together. I do their GPSs for them, and I get them going on the road. And like tomorrow morning, I'm picking up the first driver again at 5 o'clock. So then get the guys going out on the road. And yes, that's what I do these days. And it's sometimes a 24/7 job. And we try and work it to 5 days, and most of the time it's 6 days a week, yeah.
Coming back to highway ministry.
Yes.
Do you feel that what you're doing is primarily seeking to reduce accidents or to win salvations, or both?
To Yeah, I would really say it's a question of doing both. Because I think if the people see that you are praying for them as far as road safety are concerned, they really come to you and say, listen, wow, is this what you do? Can I also receive more of that, what you do? And by that way, then you start really phasing him in to ask him, do you know Jesus? Do you know what I'm talking about? This is what can happen to you. This is what you can be. And yes, we also do get, when we pray for them as far as road safety is concerned, we win a lot. And I would say salvation and accidents, or the prayer against road accidents, I would go hand in hand, yes.
Now, you're running an event on the 29th of November, just under a month's time, here in Worcester. It's a special event, and people need to hear about it. So why don't you tell them about that?
Absolutely. All right. First of all, I want to tell you how this came about. On the 2nd of May this year, 2 o'clock in the morning, I just sat up and the Lord put a picture in my head. Like, whoop, the picture is there. The time, the date, the place, everything. And he gave me the sports grounds up against the N1. And since I've been running around trying to organize this, or not even trying, I just went and I asked, listen, can we get the school grounds? Because normally we pay for that school grounds for the hiring of that evening. And when I got there, what is it you wanted for? And I said, this is for a prayer meeting. It's yours, free of charge. I'm not paying for the grounds. I'm getting everything that I need, and people are just coming in. People are sponsoring, and yes, everything is going well. So I do believe that I heard right that the Lord gave me this, because as my pastor at church says, if it doesn't come from the Lord, you will meet a wall in front of you every time. The doors will close, and not one door has closed as yet. So the 29th of November, we are meeting at 6 o'clock in the evening. There's going to be a couple of pastors praying, leading the prayer, and I'm really hoping that we will get close to about 5,000 people on that ground that evening, because this is going wide on air. The gospel stations in Cape Town and surrounds Worcester everywhere, they are broadcasting it. People from Joburg are phoning me regarding this. People from Cape Town are phoning me. And yes, the schools are even putting it on their websites. The churches are putting it on their websites. It's running on the PowerPoints of all the churches. So thank you for that. It's going, and I'm excited. And I've had two huge banners made that will really be seen from far. And I do think that people will be attracted by the banners, because there's a couple of gospel singers that are going to perform that evening. There are a couple of people doing the speeches. Our vision bearer, Mr. Jan de Bruyn, is coming down from Gauteng as well. He will be doing a short speech telling everybody about Highway Ministries there as well. And yes, I'm just looking forward to a good evening. We should be finished within about 2 hours, 6 o'clock to about 8 o'clock in the evening. We should be finished. And we're having a couple of snacks being sold there, and that money that we make from that is going for Bible distribution again. And yes, so the people must really come and join us, and don't say you've got to go and make supper. There's something there to eat, so, and there's something to drink there. Come and join us and really make yourself part of that evening and receive your blessings that evening, because I think this is what's going to happen there. Blessings are going to be there, and I'm sure that the Lord will be there, the centerpiece of that piece of ground for that evening.
Farrell, you weren't always a child of God. How did you get hooked in?
You know, you ask me that, and I'm straight thinking now back in my years at school. I remember my late mother always used to say to people when they ask her, what do you think your son is going to be one day? My son will be a minister. And I said, yeah, you know, and all right, now I never got that far, because I think the Lord takes you on byways and takes you around circles and takes you through very deep waters And I went through very, very deep waters, and the Lord really lifted me out of that. And then when I thought about myself, because I knew the Lord, you know, I know of him, let me put it that way. And I thought I was really a Christian because I grew up in a Christian house. But then in 1999, I really had that unforgettable meeting with the Lord. And it is absolutely something that you cannot forget. And shortly after that, I was baptized and I was hooked, and that was it. Since then, I've been running Akis, and I went to disciple school for a while. I didn't finish my pastoral studies. But yes, I do a lot of outreaches. I do a lot of evangelism. I preach now and again at churches. And yes, I do quite a bit of outreach, and that's my passion at this moment. So, and that's me. I'm a totally hooked child of God.
Now, you have something in this ministry that allows you to have a special affinity for truck drivers. You were one.
Absolutely. I was a truck driver for about 7 years. And while doing the truck driving, the Lord spoke to me. And in the very beginning of my truck driving season, shall I call it, the Lord spoke to me one morning and said, "Listen, I want you to minister on the roads, on the highways, on the N1 mostly, where you go, but when you drive on the N3 or when you drive on whichever road, N2 or wherever you go, you must minister, because this is what I'm looking at, because I want to curb the AIDS spreading on the N1. And that is where I started, because I started looking at something that I could distribute, and I put a pamphlet together. And I did this under the name of Wheels for Jesus. And I had this big banner, or shall I say sticker, across the top part of my windshield. And my truck was really blazing out Wheels for Jesus. And I went from place to place wherever I drove, because I did the N1 from Cape Town to Joburg about 3 times a week, up and down. And it was so much better to connect to the other truck drivers, because me being a truck driver, you could easily speak the language of the other truck driver, and you could get closer to them, and they accept you more than what they will accept a guy from outside. So yes, I can talk about experience from truck to truck evangelism, from truck to truck caring for people, talking to people. And I mean, I can write a book of what the Lord has done for me on the roads to tell me, "Listen, that person, just go and speak to him. Just give him something. Just go and pray for him. Do this." And he sent me into truck stops already where he says, "Go and pray at that kiosk. That man, tell him I see that he loves me, and pray for him." And yes, I can tell you many stories about that. So it's in those 7 years that I did the truck driving, I did a lot of ministries. I did a lot of evangelism, reaching out, handing out pamphlets, because all those I did out of my own pocket, just for the love of the spreading of the word of the Lord. So, yes, and I know that went from pillar to post, from town to town. They know about me. People wrote about the story in newspapers, and yes, that was a good part of my life. But that is now past. I'm sitting in the office now, doing that piece and getting my drivers going out. And yes, thank you. That was very nice.
Farrell van der Vesthuizen, thank you so much for giving me some of your time, because I know you don't have too much spare time, all these things in your life. So thank you for coming on to CWCP Radio. And we should perhaps admit that we're neighbors.
Absolutely.
Although we haven't spent too much time together past, but yeah, That's going to change, I hope.
Yes, absolutely.
So bless you and your family and this wonderful work that you do.
Thank you ever so much, and on your side as well, and to all the listeners, God bless you, and go well, and just remember, when you go out on the roads, please start thinking by way, road safety starts with me, and if everybody thinks that way, the road will be a better place and a safer place. Keep well, God bless.
We are serializing the book Legacy by Jasper Klote on CWCP Radio, and we are now up to Chapter 9. Regular listeners will know what this is all about, but in my personal view, it's probably one of the most significant books on financial planning, personal planning of your own finances, that you'll find anywhere in the world today. And it is bang up to date with South Africa's situation, which is not all that good, as you know, and desperately needs people to find a new way of building wealth, not just for them, but for their children and their children's children. Here is part one of rather a long chapter, chapter 9, entitled My Generational Action Plan, Design and Build a Generational Family Dynasty. After the book reading, we will have reached the end of tonight's program, and we will just slide softly into some soaking music. And if you like to soak in prayer, that's for you for a further half hour. So go with God and know how much He loves you. This is Tony signing off. Legacy, Chapter 9, My Gap Generational Action Plan. Design and Build a Generational Family Dynasty. The two most important days in any human's life is the day he was born and the day he finds out why. Mark Twain. How did other generational families do it? When we observe the activities of the well-known generational families and read about them sponsoring yet another philanthropic event or worthy cause, we can be excused if, deep down, we've accepted the fact that they live in another financial world and that we will never know what true abundance will feel like. In thinking like that, however, we immediately disqualify ourselves and our own families from ever becoming another such family in future, making positive contributions to society and providing our family members with the best there is to offer. How does one start such a generational family? Must you first make a fortune and then hope your family and those behind you won't waste it? What if right now you're in debt and may be unemployed? Is it still possible that with the right knowledge, having a great plan and taking the right action, that you too can overcome these initial obstacles and place your family on a generational path and become one of these success stories? When one observes these generational families as an outsider, it is clear that they are doing something different to the ordinary. They operate as a closed system and are almost immune to the external circumstances that affect everybody else, such as political and economic uncertainties. Over the last 100 years, these families have not only survived droughts, floods, wars, political change, recessions and depressions, but somehow have come out stronger after every setback. It is as if these families are like a self-contained passenger ship, where there is a place for every member of the family to have their basic needs of food and accommodation met, and where they can find their significance and enjoy themselves. They can interact with other members of the family when they want to, or do their own thing when they want to. If family members get sick or in discomfort, there are knowledgeable people on board to assist them in this problem. Every now and then, the ship docks somewhere in a new opportunity, and then it is up to the members to get off the ship, explore this opportunity, make of it what they want, and then get back onto the ship, sailing off to the next opportunity. At the various ports, some members get off and new ones come on board. Each member is on board the ship for a specified time period, then they too must get off when they come to the end of their lives.
Management on the ship is trained and dedicated to serve the members on the cruise. The people on the ship are made up of passengers, members doing their own thing and pursuing private careers, and serving staff, maintaining the ship and looking after the interests of the passengers. The ratio of serving staff to passengers is in the region of 30 staff to 100 passengers. The bigger the structure of the ship, the better it can handle storms and waves, so that people on the ship scarcely know there is a storm outside. Since the ship is a self-contained structure floating on the sea, the rise and fall of the water level, due to tsunamis and other natural events, is not affecting the comfort of the passengers on the ship. The ship interacts with the outside world through regular planned ports of call, where the passengers get off and explore their surroundings while the serving staff replenishes the food stocks, fuel, and other consumables on the ship. The serving staff in this context would be elders and various management structures in the generational family. To build such a ship, however, takes huge resources of manpower and finances. It needs the best brains in the field of architecture, finances, legal, mechanical engineering, and others to finally produce the structure that will provide the comfort, security, and mobility as described above. Every well-known generational family started with the founding parents who broke free from their past and set a new pathway for the successive generations in terms of new values, opportunities, and resources. Their private stories of sacrifice are often only known to the close family members, whereas the outside world only sees the end results of their sacrifice and commitment a few generations down the road when it is manifested in incredible wealth and influence in the community. Many of these founding parents had to wrestle with shortage and lack for most of their lives, and many times despaired if they would ever see the fulfillment of their dreams in their lifetime. Yet here we are today, a few generations later, reading about the successes and positive contributions of these families. The challenge presented throughout this book is that you, the reader, has a calling on your life to become that founding parent of your family dynasty and break free from the limiting beliefs and restrictions placed on you by your culture, upbringing, and society laws. On top of this, many of us need to break free from the bondage of debt. In most cases, this debt has been caused from borrowing money to finance an artificial, meaningless lifestyle imposed on you by luring advertisements designed to fill the void that comes from not having a generational purpose and focus. Yet, you are the founding parent, even if you are not yet married at the time of reading this book, or you do not have children yet. In this chapter, we will explore some ideas and guidelines that every founding parent should consider when setting out to establish their family dynasty. These guidelines have been successfully implemented in one form or another by many successful generational families, regardless of their nationality, cultural background, or education. Apart from my own observations, I have also used the observations by James Hughes, who wrote a book, Family Wealth, Keeping It in the Family, by James E. Hughes, Jr., in which he shares the result of observing generational families who have successfully built and preserved family wealth over a period of more than 100 years or three generations. To leave a lasting legacy, you need to decide and plan to be the founding parent of your family dynasty, and then commit yourself to the lifelong execution of this plan, bringing your children, next generation, alongside you, to add to and buy into this family dynasty plan. Except for the current generational families, where the children grow up being prepared daily on their generational roles and responsibilities, chances are that everyone reading this book will be the founding parent, having to start from scratch. This makes us the transition generation. The founding parents that will have to lead our families out of the one-generational mindset to a three-generational mindset. Even if you do come from a wealthy family, or your parents have started to lay the foundation of a family dynasty, if you don't think of yourself as the founding parent of your own family dynasty, The danger exists that the mindset of being a generational family can get lost, and soon all the wealth momentum gained by the founding parents will be gone, and you and your children will have to start all over again. Another analogy to appreciate the process that lies ahead for you and your family is the story of the copper beech tree. It is found in Europe, takes 150 years to reach maturity, has a lifespan of 300 years, and can grow 30 meters tall. At maturity, its base is so wide that it takes 7 adults holding hands to encircle the tree, and it produces an edible nut. Can you appreciate the courage of the founding gardener who then plants this tree, knowing full well that the tree will only reach maturity well after the lifetime of the founding gardener's children's children? Imagine nurturing the tree in the earlier years and protecting it from people who would wish to cut it off, or local governments that want to destroy it to make new roads, and nursing it through droughts and other natural disasters. Yet it is exactly this painful maturity process that allows each tree to have a beautiful, unique shape that makes it stand tall and adds value to its environment over its lifetime. 9.1. General preparation to set up a family dynasty. Decide to become the founding parents and commit to the process. Establish the family starting point. Develop a family constitution. Elect a family board. Appoint outside professionals on the board. Develop a generational wealth plan, 7-year, 21-year, 50-year, and 100-year. Implement the plan. Take ongoing action, monitor progress, and adjust the plan when necessary. 9.2. Decide to become the founding parents and commit to the process. Issues to address under this heading are disabling versus enabling attitudes. Know yourself and accept your uniqueness. Spiritual laws that drive the process. Calling the first family meeting and starting the process. 9.3. Disabling versus enabling attitudes. Disabling attitudes that block your ability to create wealth. Identifying negative attitudes about money and wealth is most helpful. It is also helpful to realize that money follows certain laws, which, if obeyed, contribute to success in this area. Do you believe any of these common negative statements about money? Money is a bad thing. This is a common attitude today. The opposite attitude is that I respect and appreciate money, and take responsibility for learning about it. I do not deserve abundance. This attitude may be rooted in guilt or an inability to receive goodness into your life. The opposite attitude is that I am open to receive all good things into my life. Being spiritual and having money do not mix. Implied here is that only selfish and greedy people have money. The Bible is often quoted as implying that money is the root of all evil. In fact, this is an incorrect quote. The correct quote is, "The love of money is the root of all evil." 1 Timothy 6:10 in the Amplified Bible. The Bible does warn us that the craving and dependency on money is a bad thing and will make people do evil things. It warns us, therefore, not to develop a dependency or love for money, but to remain dependent on our Creator for direction and provision. The Creator himself has given us another spiritual truth, however, "But you shall earnestly remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day." Deuteronomy 8:18 in the Amplified Bible. It is clear from the historical families in the Bible that those who followed their creation purpose with a daily dependency on the guidance of God and who successfully passed on their family calling till the successive generations live fulfilled and prosperous lives. For example, the story of Abraham. Money stroke wealth is a gift from God. It is true that the issue of money can get in the way of spirituality, but so can poverty. I am ignorant about money, and am always taken advantage of. Underlying this attitude is the victim mentality and hopelessness. As you resolve the money issue, you will start to see M-O-N-E-Y as my own natural energy yield. This is what makes it easier for millions of others to resolve the money issue as well. This is a spiritual truth, no matter how far-fetched it may seem. By joining the GIG membership program, www.gig-institute.com, any person can acquire the financial skills to break free from the poverty curse of the past. The real point here is to break the cycle of financial illiteracy and position your family on the road of becoming society's financial stewards. There is not enough money to go round, so I remain poor. Underlying this thought is a belief in scarcity. Most of the political philosophies are based on this belief, and their followers then set out to develop strategies on how to take away from the haves and give to the have-nots. Illiterate people are the most gullible and readily accept these populist statements from politicians. It is a planned strategy of these political parties to keep the largest portion of their constituency illiterate and poor, so that they stay gullible and easy to manipulate with empty promises. Buckminster Fuller proved years ago there is plenty to go around. He showed that wealth consists of the 103 elements and the knowledge of what to do with them. The amount of elements is fixed, and the increasing knowledge of how to use them is increasing wealth all the time. Abundance is the true state. The only reason people don't experience it are their beliefs and the expressions of those beliefs. I am single and don't need to concern myself about my successive generations. Since we rely heavily on our physical senses of touch, smell, sight, and hearing, it is difficult to see through the eye of faith a future where you will be happily married with a family and one day be the grandparent wanting the best for your future generations. This stage of your life, young and single, is however the most valuable period to adopt this generational mindset, because you are most likely to see and experience the fulfillment of your vision in your lifetime if you start timeously. What's more, if you're single at the time of reading this book, then the choosing of a spouse becomes that much more focused and meaningful. Choose your future spouse in line with this core focus of your life. It's too late for me. My children are big now, and I'm drowning in debt. If you're married and have been on your one generational journey for some time now, you have a real hard decision to make. This is not just a purchasing decision for new clothes, starting a studying course, buying a car or a house. This decision will impact the future of your children's children 60 years after your death. Perhaps you are currently in a financially challenged situation and are slowly drowning from the debt burden you took on whilst trying to fit into the one-generational mindset and lifestyle as best you could. You may even come from a family background where no one, as far as you can remember, was ever financially free, and you could come to quietly make peace with the fact that you too will have to endure the lot of being financially enslaved with no choices. If, however, you can commit to implement the 100-year plan that will be discussed later in the chapter, you can break the shackles of your past and emerge as the founding parent of your family dynasty. The GIG program is designed to get its members out of debt in 7 years and set them on a lifelong path of wealth building. It will not be so much as to what you achieve in your lifetime, but what your grandchildren will achieve in theirs, because you have started the process. In the big scheme of things, it doesn't matter when you start, as long as someone starts. I don't want to stay broke all my life, just so that the generation after me can have a better life. For people programmed in one generational thinking, this is their biggest fear. FOMO, FOMO, fear of missing out. They don't want to miss out on the good things in life and see the initial sacrifices of saving and getting out of bad debt as too big a sacrifice. The sad reality is that this one generational mindset is the reason why they will stay broke all their lives and will have to settle for the small perceived rewards their credit spending can bring them. These one generational people, however, have never been taught the power of momentum that starts to happen for generational families who start the process and stick with it for 10 years or more. If you wish to experience true joy and a growing reward in lifestyle and peace of mind, you need to get serious about your role as the founding parent and start to make the necessary adjustments to start your 100-year plan. 9.4. Know yourself and accept your uniqueness. Your association with money determines whether you attract it or not. Wealthy people have a very positive association with money. They view it in terms of the freedom, enjoyment, and pleasure it brings them. Having a negative association of money repels it from you, while a positive association attracts it to you. Entrepreneurs in the early stage of their careers know how it feels to be permanently broke, short of cash, since they invest it as fast as it comes into their business. They do it with gladness, however, because they know that being broke is a temporary condition and that soon they will be seeing the fulfillment of their dreams. Being poor, however, is a spiritual condition based on your beliefs and tends to be permanent and transferable to the next generation. How do you feel about being or becoming truly prosperous in your everyday life? A big part of the price to becoming prosperous is becoming the kind of person that handles prosperity responsibly. How do you handle your budget? If you can't be trusted in the little you have, how can you be trusted with much? One of the strengths of the GIG CFI program is how it develops your financial literacy over a 7-year period. Don't have an entitlement mentality and stop associating with those who do. Nothing comes for free. Prosperous people never look for anything for free. They are so happy to exchange value for everything. You become a wealthy person in your mind first, then you manifest it in the physical plane by becoming the kind of person that attracts prosperity to you. Train your mind to think differently. For example, bills are simply invoices for blessings you've already received. Are you still trying to become a better copy of someone else's life, or are you willing to become the best you that the Creator designed you to be? Realize that abundance, health, love, happiness, and money are infinite. 9.4.1. Spiritual Laws. Power of Conviction. People are more persuaded by the depths of your conviction than by the height of your logic. Your conviction will give you the creativity and bring the resources for you for what needs to be accomplished. If you are not convinced that the three-generational mindset is the key to breaking the poverty curse of the past and building a family dynasty, then all your reasoning will not persuade your family members to follow you on this journey and make the necessary sacrifices. Power of Agreement. In historical times, people were convicted and even stoned on the witness of 2 or 3 people in agreement. Deuteronomy 19:15 and Matthew 18:19 in the Amplified Bible. In our modern context, the spiritual power of agreement is still valid. On whatever matter 2 or more people agree, so it will be for them. Therefore, Be very careful not to be sucked in by the general negative conversations going on around you. That puts you in a state of agreement with them and brings it to come to pass for you and your friends. Let's say you and a friend meet in a restaurant, and the discussion moves to the current economic and political situation, and your friend expresses disgust for the political corruption and the detrimental effect thereof on the economy. If you agree with him that the country is in a mess and the economy is going down, then this law states that for the two of you, so shall it be. You will increasingly experience the effects of corruption and the downturn of your family's economy. Know, however, that while you are bemoaning the bad politics and the detrimental effect on the economy, a different conversation might be going on at the table next to you, where the two friends discuss the same set of circumstances. Instead of concluding that the economy is in a mess, however, they become excited about the commercial opportunities it might open up for them. Guess what? For them, it will come to pass that they will prosper economically as a result of how they use these circumstances positively. In developing your 100-year plan, ensure that you have at least one other member of the family, starting with your spouse, to agree with you and help to plan. Power of the spoken word. What you confess over yourself and your family will become your reality. You create the invisible, that which is not yet, by speaking it into existence. Once you've agreed on the family plan, bring it into all your family get-togethers and discussions and declare positively over it. What you hear constantly, you start to believe. What you believe becomes your reality. You either take control over what you hear by your self-confession and by being surrounded by like-minded people, or you allow yourself to become programmed by the one-generational system of radio, TV, and newspapers. Power of team. When Jesus came to the end of his earthly ministry, and he completed his training of his disciples, he sent them out on a practical experience trip in teams of two. Joy shared is doubled, while disappointment shared is halved. 5 of you shall chase 100, and 100 of you shall put 10,000 to flight. Your enemies shall fall before you by the sword. Leviticus 26:8 in the Amplified Bible. There is a synergy that comes from working towards the same cause as a team that just cannot be matched by trying to accomplish something on your own. Power of ask, seek, and knock. So I say to you, ask, and keep on asking, and it shall be given you. Seek, and keep on seeking, and you shall find. Knock, and keep on knocking, and the door shall be opened to you. Luke 11:9 in the Amplified Bible. True prosperity only comes to those who persevere in seeking it. Ask. Talk to people who are where you still want to go. Ask them how they did it. Pay for their meal at an upmarket restaurant while you take notes and learn. Seek. Seek to be referred to people who can open doors of opportunity for you. Seek the correct knowledge and apply yourself to ongoing learning. Knock. Continue to knock on doors of potential business opportunities. If they open for you, step in and maximize the opportunity. If they remain closed, move to the next door and repeat the process. These spiritual laws will either work for or against you, depending on how you apply them. Make sure you do it in a way that will pass on generational wealth instead of generational poverty. 942. Calling the first family meeting. Since most people reading this book will not come from generational families, it means that you, the reader, will be that founding parent that will have to start the process. We are that transitional generation that will have to move our family away from a one-generational mindset and lifestyle to that of a three-generational mindset and lifestyle. By the time people are waking up to the power of the generational message, they find themselves in one of the following stages of life. A. Ideal stage, newly married. I call this the ideal stage to start as the founding parents of the family dynasty, since you initially have only your spouse to agree with you and start to work on the 100-year family plan. As the children get born and the family grows, the children experience this generational lifestyle as natural. B. Married with a young family. If the children are still preschool, the situation is about the same as for the newly married couple, and they can immediately start bringing the generational 100-year plan into their family, starting with an agreement between husband and wife. If the children are in primary school, start involving them in the various aspects of putting the 100-year family plan together. Do the fun things together, such as looking for pictures for your dream book. Place an emphasis on sharing the family story with them and expose them as much as possible to the grandparents for the transfer of skills and values. C. Married with teenage children. At this stage, your children have pretty much established their circle of friends and made peace with where you, as a family, are placed within the conventional social structures. Chances are that they may even feel a bit embarrassed about you as parents, but love you nonetheless. To get them involved in the start-up phase of the generational family project, the following ideas may help you get their buy-in into the process. Schedule a family meeting in which you start by painting a picture of what could have been if your grandfather had understood the concept and prepared a family fund that today would have provided the current family members with the funds to allow each child to attend the private school of their choice, the funds to allow the children to pursue any extracurricular activity, sport or art, in the field of their personal passion, the funds to travel after school and expand their understanding of other cultures and opportunities, the opportunity to study any course at any university of their choice. Once they've finished their studies and have chosen a career or business, the startup capital to launch their business with zero interest loans. At 21, the keys to their own house, paid for. However, they must use the rental income from this house to start their own personal family fund for their bloodline. Add whatever else you think may have been a great benefit if you had that grandfather. Invite them to join you on the management of this family fund, but make it clear that if they don't feel ready yet, they are free not to attend future family meetings until they feel ready. Make sure, however, that if they choose this option, that you don't share your decisions at these meetings and play on their curiosity until they feel ready. Invite them to events or meetings where the generational inheritance topic will be discussed and other people will share their testimony, for example, scheduled gig events in your area. Encourage them to read biographies of such family founders. D. Children have left the home, and some may even have started their own young families. As for C above, but stress the point that the creation of this family fund will have serious limitations if it depends on your efforts alone, and that it will definitely not survive unless the major input comes from them. You may have to spend quality personal time with each child to sell them on this new family focus. Don't feel despondent if they don't see the light immediately. Even if initially you and your spouse have to start the process alone, constantly engage them by asking advice on hypothetical questions with regards to the future rules of the fund. For example, if the purpose of the fund is to provide education for the future members of the family, does it then mean that if we provided 100,000 rand for the cost of studies for person A, and person B wishes to study another course that will cost 150,000 rands, will we then have to restrict the amount available to B to just 100,000? Or should we treat each case on its own merits? Give them a copy of this book and let them buy into the concept of becoming the founding parent of their own family dynasty for themselves. E. Single-parent households. Involve your children as soon as possible. Start a support group with similar single-parent households where you keep yourself accountable to each other in reporting back on your progress on your generational actions. The assumption in the above scenarios is that these people are all first-generation people who will have to become the founding parents and make the transition from one-generation thinking to three-generation thinking. There is also the possibility of scenario F. F. You are part of the second or even third generation family where the original family wealth was created, but the succeeding generations are now consuming the wealth and are facing losing it all. You are in a very fortunate position, especially if the founding parents are still alive. Many such families are put on their generational path without having consciously designed it. The initial wealth of the founding parent necessitated the typical corporate structures that sustained it for the period of generation two and may even last until generation three. Unless the succeeding generations reconnect to the original family purpose and buy into it and take the responsibility to take stewardship of the family fund and vision, they run the danger of losing it all if there comes a change in the business environment or a disruptive technology takes the competitive edge of the business away. Make time to interview the living relatives that were closest to the founder and uncover and learn of the initiator's dreams and write the family story. Decide if, in honor of the founder, you are willing to commit to the family fund and bring your various families in line with this vision. If you can't find consensus with the other family members, then continue with seeing yourself as the new founding parent of your own family fund and incorporate as much as you can from your ancestor, but add to it from your own perspective.
Koppel's Western Cape Radio, CWCP, broadcasting from Worcester, South Africa.